Welcome to A Drip Town Limerick, Maine, a podcast on pop culture from the early 2000s and 2010s and nostalgia for people who aren't old enough to be feeling nostalgic. I'm your host, Ariane Anandita. Yes, I'm going to use my middle name, even though my whole government name is out here on this podcast. And Happy New Year. Welcome to 2023. This is the first episode of the year and it is long overdue. We are taking it all the way back to 2010, when the world was first introduced to Benadryl Cumberflet, I don't know his name, Benedict Cumberbatch, as a mop of curly brown hair, cheekbones, and his stupid upturned coat collar. We're attacking the ever controversial BBC Sherlock. Joining us today is a returning guest. We both have better audio quality now. She hasn't been on in a while. We had really shitty audio back then, but please welcome Lin Thang back to the show. Hi, Lin.
Hello.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Good. It's the middle of winter and somehow I'm not super depressed. So I would say I'm doing better than I could hope for.
Oh my gosh. Congratulations.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you. You're welcome for not being super depressed on your podcast.
Which is so good. It's so rare. It's January. This January has lasted 6 weeks. It's so long. I hate it.
I can't believe it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's insane. But for the listeners at home, could you remind them, how do we know each other?
I first met, what do you go by on this podcast? Ari?
Yeah, Ari.
Ariane? Ari? I first met Ari halfway through seventh grade, mm-hmm. when we were both suffering through international school in
hell.
Like the, you know, outskirts of Jakarta. So yeah.
The fact that it doesn't even count as Jakarta as well.
No, exactly. This is like the slums, if the slums were like for middle class and... you know, expats. I don't know if you want to keep that on the podcast. But yeah, that's how we met. And since then, we have remained fast friends through three different continents. And here we are.
That's crazy. Yeah, I haven't seen you since last summer, which feels insane to me because it feels like yesterday, but also is ages away.
Literally, always. It's always like that whenever I see you or not see you.
I know. We also like barely see each other, but every time we do, it's like no time has passed.
Literally, you're one of the most comfortable people in my life, I think, just because of how seamlessly we fall back into things. I don't know if it's because we were raised on the same like brain rotting media, but yeah.
Yeah, that's probably it, which is why we're here today. So I don't really know if I want to explain what BBC Sherlock is to people, because talking about it just sends a chill down my spine. So for the uninitiated, if you somehow missed this show, it came out in 2010, co-created by Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, who were both on Doctor Who, which we'll talk about also later. And it is a modern reimagining of the Sherlock Holmes stories. And it's set in London in 2010. And we start at the very beginning, so it's how John and Sherlock first meet. So yeah, take us back. When was the first time you saw Sherlock, and how did you hear about it, and how did you end up coming back to it?
Well, this was actually the fault of our eighth grade math teacher.
Yeah, shut up, Miss Jen.
This is deep cut. So our wonderful math teacher, Miss Jessalyn, she for some reason had all of the BBC shows that were like popular at the time downloaded on her laptop.
Very legally. And sorry, let's clarify that. Sorry, very legally.
Yeah. Obviously, we would never condone, you know, illegal practices. And I can't remember how we ended up like watching them with her, but she was probably like on her lunch break and we were terrorizing her as we often did. And we started watching it right along with her. We started getting into BBC Sherlock and Doctor Who. I think Supernatural was a later, separate incident, but yeah.
That was when we were much older, I think.
Exactly. So something about seeing Sherlock's cockiness really spoke to us as, you know, these terrible, terrible preteens. Or no, at the time we were just entering the teenhood. Mm-hmm. I think we kind of adopted him into our personality, but I still have parts of that, a lot of those characters actually in me. And I didn't realize how deeply they were ingrained into my psyche until you know, every year a new season comes out, and every year I would like watch all of them all over again as if I was a crazy person. And more recently, last summer, or well, last summer, let's say that, I was, I don't know, just in a weird place mentally and wanted to go to something comfortable and familiar. And I stumbled upon Sherlock, and it ended up doing something to me last year. I couldn't tell you what it was, but I ended up rewatching it the second I finished all four seasons. So in the span of like 5 weeks, I rewatched it about 2.5 times before I was like, okay, this is getting ridiculous. Let's move on from this before it starts, you know, screwing me up even more.
Oh my gosh. I also do that when I rewatch stuff and I finish it and I'm like, well, I'm going to start again from the beginning. That's the only natural course of action.
Exactly. Something about BBC Sherlock, it just lends itself to just, well, I wouldn't say this for all people. I guess this is just a me thing, but it really lends itself to going to that final shot. I don't know if we want to go into like spoiler territory, but the final shot of Sherlock.
Are so ridiculous, because who the fuck hasn't seen this show?
Like, we're a decade past, like,
yeah, it's,
you know,
been up for 12 years, grow up.
You should be keeping up. So yeah, the last shot of Sherlock, John, and John's child, who now they raise together. Yay. As a totally heterosexual, like, flatmate situation.
Yeah, no hetero, bro.
No hetero, you know, just, you know, two friends sitting in a London flat. And something about that shot just immediately makes me want to go back and rewatch the names Sherlock Holmes, the address is 221B Baker Street, wink. Oh,
literally, iconic. I rewatched the pilot last night, and when that scene happened, I don't know if I wanted to scream or throw up, but something in me was like, oh my gosh.
It just, it's a really visceral reaction, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's like that Leonardo DiCaprio pointing in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Exactly. Like, he said the name and the address. Oh my god.
Exactly. That's him.
Did you ever read like the books or watch any of the other adaptations? Because I know around the same time, Robert Downey Jr. was also Sherlock Holmes, and Jude Law was John Watson, and they've all somehow ended up in the MCU, which is ridiculous. I think about that all the time. Did you ever, you know, get into the other stuff?
I did. At the time when those films were coming out, I do remember watching them in cinemas, but I think because I was so deep in that like BBC Sherlock brain rot, it just never really made an impression on me. And it wasn't until, funnily enough, last winter, I think I was on a couple of long flights and wanted to fill my time, and I found out that those Sherlock movies are on Netflix. So I downloaded them both and I watched through all of them. I think I might have also been on like a RDJ brain space. This is like very shortly after watching BBC Sherlock, so it was really interesting to compare those two and be like, god, what is this? Why am I doing this to myself? The original source material I never actually read. I did subscribe to this Rowling newsletter thing now that is basically like letters from Watson, and it comes to your inbox once every few days, and it's basically just your good friend Watson telling you through these letters to you about, you know, all the adventures that he and Sherlock got up to. Funnily enough, I thought this was like, okay, this sounds like a great idea. I'm going to read these, you know, periodic emails and catch up on all these original source material. And I still can't get myself to read them. I think that there's something about the like elevated, you know, old English kind of thing that just like doesn't work for me in terms of a reader. In terms of being a reader. But yeah, I tried, and so far the thing for me is still, unfortunately, Benedict Cumberbatch in that stupid coat.
That stupid coat. And he was, all the shirts they put him in were all awfully too tight.
Weirdly tight. And they were always rolled up to like, you know, near his elbows. So there was like a whole forearm kink happening.
To show his
fandom.
Nicotine patches.
Exactly.
And I was like, bro, you quit smoking. It was that hard for Sherlock to quit smoking? I was like, oh, wait, he's a drug addict for other stuff as well. I was like, oh, I get it. As I got older, I was like, wait, I get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
The funny thing, I think, about the, at least like the modernization aspect of BBC Sherlock is that at the time, for sure, I think it really worked. Because I was like, yeah, of course, this asshole detective would text an entire room of journalists being like, wrong, which I thought was really, really funny. But it's one of those things where upon rewatching it, at least upon rewatching the pilot anyway, I've realized how much time has passed.
Mm-hmm.
How much, like, how different our world is
mm-hmm.
now, and how different our TV looks right now. And I think TV looks really monotonous at the moment, which really sucks.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, even for BBC standards, Sherlock felt kind of like, oh, this is kind of new. Like, I've never seen all these text things floating around to represent someone's brain.
That's true. Yeah. I'm just thinking about it now that you're saying it. And I was thinking that, like, is it because it was a new form of storytelling as a whole, or was it because the forms of Sherlock, the iterations of him that we had gotten, even now with, like, the, you know, release of Enola Holmes and things like mm-hmm. that, like, it's still so very much set in the, you know, olden, what is it, Elizabethan, yeah, Victorian
so who times? England? Yeah,
exactly. Old colonialist times. But, you know, this being like a really cool updated version where he's texting now, and it's like,
he loves texting.
Yeah. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting and new. But now that you say it, there's a really good point there about how I don't remember, for example, Gossip Girl is probably airing at the time. And even then, you know, it's so centered around social media, and mm-hmm. it was like people literally pulling out their phones and checking texts that way.
Yeah, we'll see their screens.
Exactly. Whereas the way that Sherlock, what do you call those anyways? Those, like,
they're supers.
Supers, yeah, mm-hmm. floating on the screen. I think it was a creative way of going about things. For all their faults, they had that going for them.
Yeah, for all their many faults, by the mm-hmm. way.
So many.
This is an interesting thing as well, because we have a really interesting relationship with Sherlock, not just as a piece of media, but also the way we consumed it growing up, I think, because Sherlock has such a rabid internet fandom.
Mm.
And I know we were going to get to this later, but I feel like the conversation's going pretty well. We might as well address the elephant in the room. I feel like I got into Sherlock the same as you, obviously through Miss Jess. And she was also the one that introduced Doctor Who to me, because I remember vividly yep. watching Blink in her class.
It's like, Blink, okay. I know.
It's, yeah. again, one of my favorite pieces of television I've ever seen in my life. I haven't rewatched it in years, so that might change once I rewatch it. But I just remember after watching it, I had to go online. Did you ever get that? Like, and then going online just reinforced it even further, just being like, I have to watch it again, and then I have to talk about it, I have to make gifs about it. Like, I think one of the first ever gif edits I made on Tumblr was to Sherlock, like, his mm-hmm. death in season 2.
Mm-hmm.
I like that footage was what I learned how to do all that
stuff.
So that's my kind of memory of it. But again, it's one of those shows where I don't feel like I have to do any research or start talking about it, because it's for some reason so fresh in my head.
It's in you. I'm telling you, anything that you have from, like, middle school, that is irreplaceably, you know, just a part of your foundation now.
Yes, Sherlock, Childish Gambino, that explains so much about
just like cocky pricks.
Yeah, cocky pricks. Oh my gosh, yeah. I'm pretty sure, like you were saying earlier, which I think is really interesting, and we don't really talk about it enough, like, all these characters we watched at such a formative age mm-hmm. really do shape kind of not just how we see ourselves, but how we kind of want to be seen, I suppose. Like, and yeah, I don't know. I do have my moments where I'm kind of like, oh, this is a bit stupid, isn't it? Like, well, I know this, you know, like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, is this Benedict Cumberbatch? That's
literally. And I think, I think the fact that both of us are in one way or another neurodivergent.
Yeah.
We have this inherent many ways. We have this inherent tendency to what's it called? Not mimic, mirror. Yeah. We mirror what we see, and you know, in a time where we're in a sensitive period of growth, and all we want to do is find our identities, and we mm-hmm. want to fit in, blah blah blah. It only stands to reason that when we have these very impressionable. These very strong impressions left on us by fictional characters that at the time we loved, we adored, they were everything. It just stands to reason that these would be the people who, unfortunately, we take with us mm-hmm. going forward in our personalities, even as we, you know, grow past it and we're like, okay, that was cringe as hell. Unfortunately, the cringe is in me now. So
oh my gosh, there's so many things I cringe at. It's also one of those things where I feel like, I think because we're at that kind of in between millennial Gen Z kind of cusp. I feel like our relationship to cringe is also a little bit different. I think where Gen Z sort of is embracing it, or if not creating it for some sort of bizarre extra layer of irony, I think millennials have a deep-seated shame associated to that cringe, where we're just like, I think I don't know, people 2 years older than us, 2 years younger than us, are a bit more introspective about how that cringe makes them feel.
Very true.
I think. And what's interesting about Sherlock, specifically this character specifically, I think it's just so funny that I think there was a sort of, because we sort of grew up very similarly for like context. You know, we both lived abroad before we moved to the school that we went to. And, you know, big readers were big, like, we did really well in school, even though it really stressed us out.
Teachers' pets.
Teachers' pets, completely. Very involved in, like, the school, like, community and stuff. But what I think Sherlock represented, at least I found this out when I was older, it's like, he represented this, like, he was the smart guy, yeah, but he was also a dick. And I think we grew up never having that opportunity to be a dick, because we had to be perfect all the time. Well, we had
good
to be
girls,
like, good girls all the time. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. But like, I feel like, I don't know if you can, you know, relate to this as well, but a lot of the characters I resonated to growing up were a bit on the other side, just being like, oh, they're kind of shitty, like,
yeah,
but I thought they were cool.
You know what, that's such an interesting point that you're making now, because I never thought of it that way, except now as I've gotten older. I used to be so shameful of the fact that I was, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Oh, swear as much as you want.
Awesome. I was a little bit of a bitch. I've always been a little bit of a bitch. And back then, I felt so much shame around that. I was like, no, I'm meant to be a good person. I'm meant to be nice. There was a whole period, you remember this, where I like didn't swear. I was actively telling people not to swear. And like,
I gave up swearing for Lent once, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And it just like a whole year happened. But like, you know, now that you mention it, all of my favorite characters, I'm talking Sherlock, I'm talking Stile Stilinski, you know, these like characters that I molded myself around were people who were kind of dicks and not ashamed of it. They were just like, I am like this. And if you don't like that, that's not my problem, you know? And I really love that. And I think I'm starting to embrace that more and more now. But absolutely, you're right.
Hell yeah. And also, I think going back to Sherlock and Stiles are actually really interesting. Stiles Stilinski is from Teen Wolf, if you don't know that, listeners. And I think I might get Lin Thang back to talk about Teen Wolf. It'll be an insane little one. But the interesting thing about them, because you mentioned, we both sort of discover as we were growing up and as we continue to discover growing up now, is that, I think there's something a little bit interesting about our brains that nobody told us about. And I kind of see that in Sherlock and Stiles and Abed from Community. And Troy from Community, even. And I'm like, oh, wait, are they?
Exactly. All of these characters.
Divergent as well.
All these characters who were so, they're just neurodivergent coded. And that's why we just latched onto them like that. Because we saw in them something that we didn't even have a name for at the time.
Yeah. We were just like, am I mentally ill?
Literally, I thought my brain was just broken. And apparently, you know, I'm not. And like, I have these fictional characters to prove that.
And I was like, my brain is broken, but I just aced that math test. What make it make sense? And then that was also a thing with Sherlock as well. I think academia played such a role in our lives, and obviously as part of his character, because so in this version, he is still a detective, but he has really good relationships with like St. Bart's, so like the hospital. And he clearly knows a lot of these people in these worlds. He knows a lot of doctors. He knows a lot of scholars. And he sits in this really interesting place that I don't think we see anymore. Like he's a private detective. He's a consulting detective, which I hate that he says. And I was like, how can you afford that living in your flat in bloody like fucking central London?
Exactly.
Literally rewatching that pilot when John meets his mate who introduces him to Sherlock, being like, I know someone, he's got a flat in central London. And I was like,
what money are you making?
I was like, on an army pension. John says himself, I can't afford to live in London on an army pension. And I'm like, you can't afford to live in central London I was like, how are you doing that? And then it got me thinking to like, when we were kids, we didn't think about this, obviously. We didn't, you know, and then now we're older. We're like, oh my God, cost of living crisis.
It's literally.
And I think it's just really interesting watching it now, literally almost to the
to the day of, like, you know, 10 years on.
Mm.
So bizarre.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a different lens entirely when you're older and you can appreciate, especially, I mean, Ari, it must be hugely different for you because you actually lived in London. Yeah. I can't even say that. And, you know, to have the lens of, like, experience and to know that struggle firsthand.
I was like, what money? How much is the police paying you to do these cases?
This is nepotism, by the way. I like, it's literally just this dude who is, you know, Sherlock's brother running the government and paying for all of this to happen because
Sherlock Holmes, the Nepo baby of the year.
The ultimate Nepo baby.
I want to talk a little bit about Sherlock, just as a character. So Sherlock, Shirley, as we know. As we learn to call him later on. He takes on this case, the first one, Studying Pink. And I think so the show goes, they're 3 hour long episodes, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe just over an hour, yeah.
Just over an hour, yeah. And yeah, it's in grand British telly tradition, limited series, 3 episodes every season. Like, you're watching, you know, tiny movies. And in the first season, we sort of see Sherlock as this really, really eccentric man. I kind of want to get
putting
to
it
know,
nicely.
Yes, putting it really nicely. I want to know kind of your thoughts about, I guess, because I think Sherlock Holmes is an archetype that we all know in popular culture, but this version of Sherlock specifically, I kind of want to know your thoughts about how he's changed throughout that time, or how you've received him. I know we talked about it a little bit in the beginning, but, like, specifically Sherlock. We'll get to John and Moriarty and them a lot.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sherlock, I think, he is the beating heart of the show, right? We are told the show through the lens of John, technically, but Sherlock is really the reason why we're here. It's in the title.
Yeah.
And you can tell when you first meet him, and he's set up to be this dick who only cares about his job and who only, you know, cares about the intellectual prowess that he holds. You can tell that, like, okay, drop John Watson on him, drop the... the nemesis that at this point we don't know of yet in the very first season, and, like, watch him change, right? And he does, to a certain extent, in the first few seasons, I think, especially in the quote-unquote death scene that we see in season 2, where he's crying on the phone saying goodbye, John, and it's like, oh my god, he has human emotions for the first time.
He cares, and he cares about John.
Exactly. Oh god, that's a whole other thing. Oh god,
we'll get to that.
It's too big, we can't touch that now. But it's in seasons 3 and 4, I think, that he really starts to change, and I think it's because he had that time. I mean, this is mostly, like, fan fiction thinking, I'm not gonna lie, but he had that time. I think it was, what, 2 years being away from John Watson. And I think he's come to realize, like, I'm actually not at all this cold, unfeeling creature I always believed myself to be. So when he comes back, he's desperate for John's approval. He's desperate to have a place with, you know, in that house now, with John and Mary getting married in the second episode of season 3. And he literally, there's, like, one of the most tragic scenes, I think, in the whole show is when he's walking away from John and Mary's reception, totally alone with a party going on behind him, because he's kind of, like, saying, I don't belong in that world anymore.
Yeah.
I am doomed to be alone. And for the first time, we see, like, how much that affects him. Especially after he's put so much care into the whole wedding and kind of giving them his blessing. And then in season 4, again, we see, spoiler central, we see how much he changes when Mary dies, and he loses John because John is angry with him, and he literally relapses. He says it's for a case, and in a way it is, but, you know, I'm sure a part of him being the addict that he is kind of, like, needed to do that anyway, or wanted to at the very least. So he really does go from this, like, dickish, cerebral, hyper intelligent, unfeeling detective to, by the end of it, a brother to 2 siblings. So that's a whole other plot line. He becomes the, I think, godfather for John's child, and he's, you know, a confirmed bachelor with John in his flat, with, you know, John's wife being dead. And he really does transform by the end of it into someone who's actually sympathetic. And you really, or I really anyway, I can't speak for everyone, I really came to adore this man so much because of how much he transformed, and he learns that feelings don't make him a poor detective, and yeah, it doesn't make him exactly. And I think especially at the point when that came out, which was several years after middle school, I think I was well into university at this point. I think that was a message that I at the time needed to hear as well. Mm-hmm. So it's crazy to me how Sherlock's transformation and his development mirrored and mirrors my own throughout the time that I was watching the show. But yeah, Sherlock's a fascinating character.
Oh yeah, it's really interesting how, like, I think I don't want to harp on the point too much because we've already addressed it like a couple times, just like him kind of being, as you said, kind of like neurodivergent coded and sort of being told, or at least he kind of convinced himself that whatever that he cannot feel or he should not feel.
Mm.
And then the fact that he undoes all of that is also kind of, yeah, like you said, really reflective of I think just growing up in general, because, you know, we're both from very Asian, like, repressive backgrounds. Yeah. And then in, obviously British people are super, super repressed as well.
Oh God.
And to sort of, it's also interesting how that's portrayed on the show. Just the Britishness, I think Sherlock, BBC Sherlock, has really rebranded Britishness, if not reinforced that sort of, like, keep calm, carry on. Like,
yeah, I mean, they were all, aside from, I think, two characters, they were all middle-aged, white, cishet British men.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so I can barely remember people of color on that show, except for maybe Sally.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, there's Donovan. Gemma Chan, quote unquote, in that one episode where she then dies anyway.
And she dies anyway. And I was like, damn, she eats in this. Like, why isn't she acting like this now? Sorry, Gemma. Sorry, Byrne. What about John? Let's move on to John.
Mm.
John Watson, our little voyeur. He has a blog, which I think is so cute and so 2010s, because if they remade the show, which I'm so scared they might, John would have a Twitter. Like, he would have,
it
would be, well, a Twitter with a thread. He would have a Substack, actually. He'd be just like me.
I was gonna say, like, I think it'd be longer than tweets.
Yeah, he got a newsletter.
Literally. Yeah, I mean, theoretically the blog starts because his therapist advises him to, right? Mm-hmm. So in this day and age, 100% it would be a Substack.
Yeah. Oh God, John, yeah, that opening, I was about to tell you last night, but I was like, I'll save it for today. When I was watching it, so the show, the first episode opens with this montage of war, of, like, you know, war in the Middle East specifically. And then it cuts to John waking up. It's a nightmare. He suffers from PTSD, clearly. He's just come home from Afghanistan. And I was just like, wait, I forgot that this is how the show starts. I really did. I thought they just meet, like, and then you get into what the case is. You get into the murder, and I'm just like, oh, okay. I don't know. I just thought, like, it doesn't feel like a procedural. Do you know what I mean? I think, like, British TV and American TV, most Western TV, when it comes to, like, murders and police stories, they're very much formulaic. And there was something about Sherlock that, even though it was formulaic, clearly they're following a pattern, it still felt new. And I think John has a lot to do with that. I don't know. How do you, I know that we were both quite attached to Sherlock, and I think growing up, I've started to appreciate John a little more, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on him.
Oh God. I think,
to unpack. Sorry, loaded question.
No, this is, I've never been asked or been pushed to think about John very much. I think I just fully devoted my time to having brain worms about Sherlock. But John Watson is I think he's such an interesting character because he's so British. Sherlock is like a weird little dude, but John Watson, I think, is meant to encapsulate the modern British man at the time. You know, the whole keep calm, carry on thing, that was 100% him. Do you remember the crying scene at Sherlock's grave where,
oh yeah,
You don't even see him, really. You see the reflection of him on the grave, and all he does is kind of, like, tip his head down. You can see his shoulders shake, but there's no sound coming from him, no nothing. He's this very stoic character, and I think it's a really interesting juxtaposition to put someone like him and someone like Sherlock, who's this huge whirl of emotions and things like that. And then, you know, as the story progresses, and technically this was at the very first two seasons, I would say it was very much told through his perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, it opens with his nightmare, and it closes on Sherlock watching him, but you know, he's watching John.
It's still John. Yeah.
Exactly. It shifts in the later seasons, I think, because John's kind of moved on a little bit from Sherlock. He keeps getting pulled back in because he can't get away from it, and that's a whole like plot line that they touch on.
What a relationship.
Yeah, it's really codependent and unhealthy in a sense. But you know, he really is just this very stable man, and he has his emotional outbursts, and he has these moments throughout the show where you can tell that like it all means something differently to him than what Sherlock understands it to be, right? Their relationship and the cases they go on and all that. But he is still this steadfast presence throughout the whole show. And I've never really thought about him, to be honest. How about you? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm kind of on the same vein of like, I've never really had to think about John. I never really thought about John in the show anyway, because he's our way in.
Yeah.
But then you kind of see in season 3 and 4, at least, like, so we get the addition of, you know, Amanda Abington as Mary, who at the time was in a relationship with Martin Freeman, who plays John Watson. And I just think that, I think in season 3 and 4, maybe he spoke to them, to the writers of the show, or maybe the writers just decided it organically, just being like, oh, I think let's give John more things to do.
Right.
Because I feel like he didn't have that many things to do in the first two seasons, aside from being our way in, aside from being Sherlock's buddy, aside from being this very clearly repressed, capable doctor. He feels like just a normal guy. Mm-hmm.
And that was deliberate, right?
At the time, yeah, for sure.
Because they were very much trying to say, like, look, this is what normal people are like. And I think this is an actual dialogue Sherlock has, like, oh, you're so ordinary.
You're so ordinary, Watson.
Right? And in comparison, you have this brilliant Sherlock, blah, 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 blah. So absolutely, in the first few seasons, 100% he's meant to be just your average man.
Yeah.
Non-Sherlock.
And then I love the little hit count on his website.
Oh, yeah, bless. Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, those were a lot of views back in the day. You know what I mean? Like, if it gets stuck at 1,085, like, damn, that's numbers. Like, but then now I'm like, it needs to be 1,000,000 for it to be numbers. And it's kind of crazy. Anyway, but yeah, I think John is like one of those characters where you can definitely tell that this is a white guy writing himself in, you know, like he really wants to be
100%.
Like, it feels very voyeuristic, and it feels ironically sort of reflective of how the fans kind of treat John and Sherlock. Like, it feels very projected self. I don't know, because John seems like such a blank slate. That's how I think, anyway. And then so you got John, you got Sherlock. They live together in this flat, 221B Baker Street. Their landlady lives there with them, Mrs. Hudson, who's brilliant.
I'm not your housekeeper, dear.
Oh my gosh, she's literally treats her like a housekeeper. The flat's always in shambles. I don't know if you've ever been to 221B Baker Street.
No, isn't that criminal? I've never made the trek.
My god, I'm shocked that I didn't take you, actually. Next time.
I know.
I've been to the Sherlock Museum twice, because every time, so my parents, the first time we came to London, which is like 2014, 2015, obviously I had to go. You know,
of course,
and then
of course,
they did have BBC Sherlock merch. That's just to nobody's surprise, and the line wrapped around the block. Like,
oh god, yeah, of course it did in 2015.
It was like peak, and then I came back again because my dad was like, "Oh, your uncle's in town. You got to, you know, play tour guide for a little bit." And then I was like, "Oh, okay, we'll go to Arsenal Stadium. Great." But then my uncle was like, "Can we go to see where Sherlock Holmes lives?" And I was like, "Oh, do you know it's actually a museum?" It's like, oh, no way. And then it's basically like you actually go up into the flat, and it's like all old timey and stuff, and you know, all of Arthur Conan Doyle's little artifacts. And then you got the gift shop.
Is the layout of that museum the same as the BBC Sherlock layout, or is it like set up differently in terms of like the rooms?
Smaller. Much okay. yeah because that's why there's always a line, because it's just so too tiny to get people
the
in.
Reason why I'm asking is because in Enola Holmes I mm-hmm. noticed that they have the apartment set up very similarly, and as far mm-hmm. as I know there is no correlation or overlap between those two bodies of work, so mm-hmm. I was just like, is it inspired by real life, like what is this?
I think it is inspired by real life a little bit in terms of layout, but I remember it being so tiny that like oh this was
well it stands to reason. Look, if you're gonna afford a flat in central London, it's gonna be tiny.
Yeah, that's the only way it makes sense. And then Speedy's, like that cafe, is like up the road from where the show is, which is really really interesting. I had fish and chips there, which is grand. It's like, that's so fucking, what a fucking English sentence to say, like a stereotype to say, like what else did you have? Fucking black tea there, bloody hell. That's the thing about John and Sherlock, and I feel like we're getting into this too early, but culturally, John and Sherlock sat in this very niche, like, it seems niche to me now, but back then it felt like it was everywhere.
Yeah, it really was, and I think...
But yeah, Sherlock on the internet, by the way, to for those of you who don't know, were often paired together, shipped, I hate that word... as a
coward, why?
I know, coward. Like, I was like, don't turn back on your culture. So they were known as John Locke, and many, many fans saw them as a romantic pair, which spawned lots of, you know, fan art, which Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman had to look at on Graham Norton or something. As you do with, like, I think they did that to Fassbender and James McAvoy.
Yeah.
X-Men as well, and John Locke spawned you know, fan fiction galore. I wanted to talk about that a little bit, just let's address the elephant in the room.
Let's fucking do it.
So John Locke, I actually don't even know how to start, like on my notes it just says John Locke Eel was season 4, John Locke was ick, because it gives me the ick now in the future. Not because of the pairing itself, but because the kind of cultural juggernaut that it was.
Honestly, looking back at it, I think that was the first time it really set in for me why fandom and creator always had to remain separate. Because at the time, I don't think that line had been so clearly drawn. I think we're better about the boundaries now as a collective, but back then, you know, as you said, they were literally shoving these like fan arts in their face, and people were asking
really
questions about it. Exactly, and they did that so deliberately, like they were just doing it to get a reaction, right? Right, and like at cons and things, people would obviously ask about John Locke and what do you think about the gays and all that, and it's like it was such an almost traumatizing experience the fandom side, at least, especially as someone who couldn't control any of that, you know, the people who were shoving all of this in the faces of Mark Gatiss and Moffat and Cumberbatch, Freeman, whatever, they weren't us, we were in Southeast Asia. But it was just such a horrific experience, and I think generally people were the fanaticism, the levels of fanaticism in the John Locke fandom specifically, maybe it's a Sherlock as a whole, of course, but John Lockers,
rabid,
insane.
And I think it goes to, I don't know, the way I see it now looking back, obviously I was kind of in it because everyone you follow on Tumblr is in it, you know? Or like you get stuff, and this was like a common thing online, be it Tumblr, Twitter, you kind of learn things about other shows or other fandoms via osmosis, because people are just into so many different things at the same time, and these are the people you follow. And I wasn't made aware of this until I had grown up, you know, that apparently there was I didn't know about this, and it makes me sound ancient that I didn't know about this, and I learned about it through a YouTube video essay that I didn't know about the John Locke conspiracy. I was not aware of that at the time.
What's the John Locke conspiracy?
Oh my gosh. So I saw this Sarah Zedd video I don't know, I think during the pandemic where I was just like, I need to, again, like you say, I need some familiar comfort. But I was also in that phase of like, I need to think about the things I consume. And Sarah Zen, who's this YouTuber, she does all these essays about these specific cultural touchstones of the internet. So like Sherlock, Supernatural, shit like that. And she apparently, she did this really long, I think it's like a 2-hour video about something called the John Locke conspiracy, which is apparently a theory that many, of course, John Locke fans had about John Locke being Endgame from the very beginning of the show.
What?
And I'm like, hold up, wait. And then apparently this has caused a lot of just online tension, not just among fans, and then also that thing of I think in seasons 3 and 4 there was a moment where I think Moffat and Gatiss became hyper aware of, you know, what the fans thought and what the fans wanted, and decided to either make fun of or service that. And that kind of came off the back of that as well, and it caused fights between people, and I think there was like a scam involved. I don't really remember that well. I should have researched it before this. I think it was also, for me anyway, I don't know about you, it was like one of the first instances of like, oh, I didn't know people wrote stories about stories that already existed.
Oh, honey, no, I was a Potterhead before this, so I was in it.
Yeah, I didn't even know about Harry Potter fan fiction. Do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't know about that.
Oh, you're a virgin.
I was. Until Sherlock ruined my life.
My God, I can't believe this was your introduction. Okay.
Yeah. And then that got into like, wait, so if they've got one for this, they've got one for everything. And then, oh my God, I was right. They got one for bloody everything. They got bloody Naruto fanfiction, for fuck's sake. But yeah, no, I just think it's crazy that it's taken on such a life of its own that it's become like a tiny subculture. Like, people were getting in fights over this, you know what I mean? Like,
Oh, yeah.
I'm not friends with this group of creators. I'm not friends with these group of people because they don't believe this. And I'm like, that's insane to me. It sounds like a cult. I'm sorry.
It really was. And like, I don't know, it was one of those things where now we have a great phrase for it, which is touch grass, right?
Yeah,
back then it was all consuming. And honestly, we were like, you know, 12, 13, however old we are, which is a little bit more understandable why we were so insane over this. There were people in that fandom well into their 20s, 30s, 40s who were just as madly into all of this discourse and like online, you know, fights, and these things just were so nonsensical looking back. But they were like very much into it, and they would be getting into fights on Tumblr with like teenagers because, you know,
literally. And then you gotta talk your, like, I don't know, 21-year-old mutual off the ledge at age 13,
literally,
like, over Sherlock Holmes, which is mad to me.
Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about villains on the show.
Oh, my favorite. Yes.
I love a good villain. I adore Andrew Scott, right? I adore Moriarty.
I'm so glad now a wider population appreciates Andrew Scott, by the way, that he's getting booked for things again, because he really is a phenomenal actor.
Phenomenal actor. Literally, I was like, when Fleabag season 2 first came out, I went, oh my God.
Yeah.
And then now everybody's like, oh my God, Hot Priest. And I was
Hot
like,
Priest.
I was like, where have you guys been?
That is my Moriarty.
Exactly. Let's talk about Moriarty. We don't meet him until the end.
Season one, episode three.
Yeah, pool, the iconic pool
the
scene.
Pool.
Which was a highlight
for Moriarty. Jim Moriarty.
Oh my God. Oof. I love. So he is essentially like the antithesis to Sherlock, but also very similar to him, I think. But then it's that dichotomy of like, you know, good versus evil. It feels very classic. But yeah, I wanted to get your thoughts on Moriarty.
Right. So here's something that I have just kind of discovered with the neurodivergent, like, eye opened. I realize that, two things. One, Moriarty is what Sherlock is if he had never experienced any form of human interaction, right? Sherlock was protected by his brother, who looked out for him and cared for him, even if it was detrimental. Sherlock had Molly Hooper and other, you know, implied staff at St. Bart's. Sherlock had John eventually, and
Lestrade,
he was able to, like,
Lestrade,
who saved him from his sort of junkie days. And it's strongly implied that Moriarty never had any of this, right?
Yeah.
He grew up very much alone, and he didn't really have any sort of influence beyond his own mental world, which was, you know, very violent, honestly. Yeah. Drowned a kid at 12 years old. So that's the first observation. The second one is that, really, as you said, Moriarty is a reflection of Sherlock, right? And if Sherlock is neurodivergent, stands to reason that Moriarty is too. Yeah. And I realized that every single time that man was like, you know, why do any of this? Because I'm bored. I'm like, King, you're just understimulated as a neurodivergent person. Yeah. You don't need to go murdering people. Just go to therapy and get a prescription.
Yeah. Like, men will do anything but go to therapy.
But go to therapy, exactly. So really, I loved kind of, you know,
murder is just him stimming, like
exactly. No, literally, like, you know, he's you know, breaking into the Bank of England playing classical music. Like, tell me that's not stimming.
Yeah.
Tell me that's not stimming.
And like, he loops the song over and you're like, I get it. Like,
literally. Literally. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's really interesting. The sort of idea that like Sherlock has a semblance of a community around him and Moriarty doesn't. And I don't want to give the writers of this credit, because clearly I don't think they thought about this.
I don't think so.
Yeah, like just the idea of nature versus nurture when it comes to those two. And what I remember the most about Moriarty was his little, like, you know, tapping on the couch in like binary.
The binary.
And then it turns out to be fucking bullshit. And I was like, yo, that man is ridiculous.
I honestly still very much enjoy him as a villain. I think.
Oh my gosh, same.
I don't remember having any kind of like similar sort of energy from any other fictional characters at the time. I really couldn't think of a single person who had that sort of rabid, like, unhinged thing, but he looked so unassuming. He was this tiny man. And more recently, Andrew Scott actually did a video you know, kind of talking through his career, and he did say that he knew he was an unassuming looking man. He looked very much unthreatening, and that's why it was so interesting for him to step into the role of Jim Moriarty and play this like unhinged lunatic, just because it's such a oxymoron to the way that he appears.
Yeah, and Moriarty's a bit of a chameleon as well. Like, I think that's another major difference to Sherlock. Sherlock can't mask, I think. But Moriarty can do it so well, to the point he literally becomes other people. Like,
yeah.
But when he becomes, does he become Molly's boyfriend? Am I messing that up?
He did. He became Molly's boyfriend. He also became that reporter's, like, well, they were living together for protection or whatever. But, you know, he was definitely something. Although, to that point, Sherlock does end up doing a very similar thing in season 3.
Yeah, with Janine.
Mm-hmm.
I remember. I don't know why I don't remember the other girls. yeah, that's really...
But yeah, you're right. Jim Moriarty is an actor. He's a performer. He's a theater gay. He is.
He's a theater gay. He's a theater gay that can't communicate how he feels to another man and decides to off himself off the roof of a prominent hospital.
As all theater gays do.
Literally. Oh my goodness. I want to talk a little bit about... I actually don't really want to talk about Mycroft, because I don't think I can talk about Mycroft, because I don't really know much about Mycroft to begin with, because he's this shadowy figure. He works for the government and seems to have endless plot armor and power, so he seems a bit like a non sequitur at this point. But I wanted to talk about Irene Adler.
Yes, one of my personal favorites.
I adore her. Oh my gosh. So Irene, we first see in A Scandal in Belgravia, which is the first episode of season 2.
Correct.
Right? Yeah. And she is a dominatrix in this version. And she's British in this version, because I think in the books and in the Sherlock Holmes movies with Robert Downey Jr., she's American.
I didn't know that. I was really surprised when I watched the RDJ version, and it was who was it? It was Regina
It was Rachel McAdams.
Rachel McAdams in an American accent. I was like, whoa, wait, what? What? What is this? Is this a choice, or was that the choice?
She can't do the voice. Can she not do the accent?
I was literally thinking, like, is that they couldn't do it for RDJ, so they just made Rachel McAdams, like.
RDJ.
Never watched those movies expecting a good accent, by the way.
Unless you're Jude Law. If Jude Law has a fucked up accent, like, that would be something. Jude Law, Stephen Fry, they weren't doing their accents right.
Exactly.
The country is exactly in shambles. But yeah, RDJ's accent was really funny. But yeah, Irene, I thought, she was the mother of all girl bosses. I don't know.
Oh my God, literally. Literally. The very first thing we see her do, by the way, is after hanging up the phone on Moriarty, we find out, she goes into the room and she goes, ready for your punishment, your highness, or something like that. And she cracks a whip and I'm like, what in the sexy as hell entrance is this? Like,
yeah, I was like,
so powerful.
Yeah, and I was like, what was she going to do that whip? Like, what's she going to use that whip for at age 13? Being like, what is she doing?
God, yeah.
And then you're like, oh shit, she's blackmailing.
Yeah, and she member. Exactly, and at first you're like, I don't know, you really don't know what to expect from this person, I think, at the start, but then she comes out and she's naked, right? And that's how she introduces herself to Sherlock, and she plays him from the very beginning, and she continues playing him with the cheek kiss, where you know, she brings him this unintelligible email with a string of codes that she just for the life of her can't decipher, and she needs a sexy brainiac to do it for her, and he literally does it so quickly that in the span of one cheek kiss she has everything that she needs to overthrow a plot the British government had been putting together for months to get around a terrorism threat. So she was a very powerful, like, she was the epitome of girl boss. Was it gatekeep girl boss?
Gaslight, gatekeep girl boss.
That's the one.
Yeah. And gosh, I think it's one of those things where I have really mixed feelings about just the way she was, maybe the way she was received, because I thought she was really cool and I thought she was really powerful. But I know that, like, there's been criticisms of her as a female character, and we know Moffat and Gatiss aren't exactly the best in writing women. But I don't know, Irene felt like both the exception and the norm, because she was this sort of like very powerful, kind of almost oversexed, kind of again another antithesis to Sherlock, because I'm pretty sure Sherlock's a fucking virgin.
Yeah, that's like, literally something that she says, right?
Yeah. And yeah, just having, and then that again, I think might go through the whole, it's not really, like, I feel like Sherlock in the movies or in the books is a bit of a playboy. You know, or in like the Billy Wilder version, Sherlock is very clearly a homosexual. But there was something about this that just felt like generationally right for like the show. Like, he's even more repressed. He's even more awkward talking about sex. I feel like people at the time, and certainly teenagers, kind of saved that for their fan fiction. They saved that for their friends online.
But did,
like,
in real
life, it's like, did they ever? Yeah. But like in real life, it's like, you know, at least, like, you know, the way we grew up. But like, Irene is just this, oh gosh, I'm obsessed with, and she delivers the iconic I am Sherlock, by the way, which is just merchandising.
If you've ever seen these on, exactly, if you've ever seen this on t-shirts or phone backgrounds, like, that's her trademark,
which is both like insane and hilarious, pays me off so bad, but also, like, I mean, what else was it gonna be? And I was like, I am locked. I was like, yeah, you're locked, just enter the code. And then it was like, oh my God.
I know. And that, you can look, that was a paradigm shift in fandom. Like, you could not go anywhere on the internet in those days right after that reveal happened without running into it. It was such a powerful moment in television history. You cannot convince me otherwise. Like, I think even now you kind of can cringe at a lot of the things that happens in BBC Sherlock, but that episode and that moment, revolutionary.
I think it is one of the show's best episodes, her episode.
Genuinely, it's actually surprising to me what you're saying, that she you know, there's criticism and discourse around her, because obviously I get that she feels a little bit flat in the sense of, you know, she's always attached to Sherlock and she's very much just this sexy, powerful woman using her body to get what she wants. But like, honestly, as much as I support women's rights, I support their wrongs.
I love
and she was
wrongs.
Full of that.
Yeah, I support women's wrongs as well. And I think the criticism for her, I think, also comes out of that John Locke fandom, going back to that. I feel like they didn't like anyone who was with Sherlock. The same, I think, happened to Mary, where like, she's getting in the way of these two. But I fucking love Mary, mate. Laughing. Yep. She's so lit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, women in this show is just...
There's just a lot of... You're right. There's a lot of sexism in shipping culture, with, you know, slash fan fiction especially, that any woman who is involved in the show is like a threat, quote unquote, threat to their, you know, precious pairing, who obviously has to be endgame and canon and all that. And it's led to some of the worst vitriol I've ever seen against the actual wife of the actual actor who plays their darling character on the show. It was horrendous how Amanda Avington was treated when she came on to the show.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And I thought she was so brilliant.
Mm-hmm. As Mary. She really was. Yeah, she really absolutely was.
That twist. I know it's like a little corny, but like, it's cool that she's a spy. Care. Bloody hell.
Exactly. I don't care how corny it is. It was brilliant.
It's like, it's slay. She slayed. I just think like fandom specifically, and I think that's what I find more interesting about talking about Sherlock. I think the culture of that fandom kind of replicated or became the norm of other subcultures. Like, clearly the supernatural fandom was like that. Clearly I don't really see that in Doctor Who, because Doctor Who's a bit nerdier and a bit more specific. So there are too many things going on in Doctor Who.
I think what it is that theory that fan fiction is only born out of bad writing, and Doctor Who just had better writing.
Yeah, true.
And Supernatural and Sherlock had a lot more plot holes and was a lot more open to, you know, being fixed up by
fans. Yeah. But then, like, I also see that in fans. I see that in the One Direction fandom. Like, and then I see that in the Teen Wolf fandom. I see that in anime fandoms. I see that it was this culture that was across the board that was just so... There was a lot of internalized misogyny involved. And I was like, why are you guys acting weird? But at the time, obviously, at, like, you know, 13, 14, 15, at 12 even... That doesn't register to you because, yeah, like you're saying, everything is impressed upon you. And then I think there's a lot of psychological, you know.
It was very much the age of, like, I'm not like other girls. And that was not only the norm, it was encouraged. Like, you don't want to be like other girls. And, obviously that narrative has drastically shifted since then. But internalized misogyny was so rampant and everybody just, it was... expected of women to have that, really. It created for a really nasty culture online, I'll say that much.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And I think, like, I don't know, I see it on Twitter now with younger kids, so it's like kids are like our brothers' ages, like they're not even that young anymore now. They're kids younger.
No, they're like
them.
In their 20s.
Their 20s now, which is ridiculous. But they're like, you know, kids that were born in like the 2000s, where they're still fighting and arguing the same way with even less information or basis compared to what we were seeing growing up, which I think is insane. And for some reason in my head, I've always credited Super Hoolock for that. Mm-hmm. I've always credited, you know, One Direction fans for that culture, even though probably people older than us have seen an iteration of that with whatever they were watching in the culture, pre-internet cultures. Insane. What are some highlights from the show that you think about a lot?
Okay, so obviously, as we were saying, Irene Adler is just such a phenomenal character, and it really is tragic that she only stayed for one episode. I was hoping she'd like come back at some point. She was such a fascinating character. Exactly. But my personal favorite, honestly, is the season 3 episode 2, the wedding of John and Mary. I loved that on a creation basis the color scheme was entirely different from anything else on the show. And something about that just really tickles my brain. I think it's the yellow. I just love the color yellow. And it was
favorite
so
animal
bright.
Is ducks
and bees. So the yellow was incredible, and it's all, you know, the whatchamacallit, not color coding, what is it?
What,
like the coloring,
the color grading was really, really
grading.
Nice,
that's the one.
Happy.
The color grading is like pastels, and it's very cute. And we also get to see a very interesting side to Sherlock, where he navigates humanity instead of like the usual stuff that we see, the kind of procedural things. It did end up becoming a, you know, solve the
murder
mystery, but there is a wonderful line in that episode where who was it that goes, I think they're talking to John Watson, and they're saying to John Watson, don't give me a second.
No worries.
This might be a long ass pause. You're gonna have to edit this out.
No, that's okay. I'm trying to remember season three a little better than I do season four. But
season four, oh god, season four is a train wreck. You don't have to remember anything from there. don't solve the murder, save the life. I think that's that line was so fundamental to my understanding of John Watson. We talked about this previously, that he was, you know, the antithesis of Sherlock. And that's exactly what the characters in the show, this is canon, was saying to him as well. Don't solve the mystery, save the life.
And you're a doctor, save the life. Like, that's who you
exactly
are.
Exactly.
I think Sherlock says that at some point. I don't know if it was to John, it might have been, and then he was like,
it was to exactly yeah. it was very much, you know,
Alfie he Enoch was saying was to, in that episode
Alfie you know now that was a cultural revolution. Oh, that man. Was like when Ooh. Harry Potter had just sort of ended, and the whole J.K. Rowling thing had yet to really come out
out. Dean Thomas is fit, like.
So that was a really interesting episode. I personally, and I know this is a controversial opinion, I don't dislike the introduction of this sister Holmes. I know a lot of people, and I think we're going to touch on this a little bit later, possibly. And a lot of people hated the fact that there's a sudden like third Holmes sibling. But I thought, you know, kind of not taking it too seriously, I thought it was a really interesting way for the story to go. I was like, huh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then like Enola Holmes came out, and I was like, oh, so there is a sister.
They were the blueprint. I do not care.
Yeah. No, I only started remembering that halfway through our conversation, being like, oh yeah, there was a bit. Redbeard has a sister. Things to do with the winds and Sherlock misremembering things and protecting himself from his own trauma. His sister was the sociopath. And that prison that she was in is fucking stupid. It's like an escape room. But again, yeah, I would watch that episode over and over because it's so stupid.
It is stupid. I love the ending, though. I love the way that it wraps up Sherlock's entire storyline. And
and them playing the violin together. The violin, was really
exactly.
Sweet. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, I also just remembered that Mads Mikkelsen's older brother was on the show. Was that
Lars Mikkelsen.
Lars Mikkelsen. Was that season three?
End of season three. Yeah.
End of season three. Oh, yeah. This is how Mary dies. No. This was before that. She died before
this
that.
This is how he was threatening Mary.
Yeah.
And they kill the guy for her.
Yeah.
The way she dies is in season four, episode one.
Which is again also stupid season four. But yeah, no, that Lars Mikkelsen is a villain. I can't even remember his name on the show, but he was this guy,
Magnuson.
Yeah, Magnuson. And he was this guy that had like a lot of information about people, right? And then the reveal.
reveal. I don't care very much for this episode at all, and for this villain. I think he's really boring. I got what he's they were trying throwaway, to do to make him scary, but he really didn't have the same like emotional impact on me the way like Moriarty did, or even Irene Adler. But that plot twist, I will say, had my jaw on the floor.
I was like, and I oop,
right? And like I paused the episode just to like process it for a little bit, because it was such an unexpected plot twist. I don't know why it was unexpected. I should have seen it coming. But it was so like, oh my god, Sherlock just got one-upped the same way he one-ups people.
Sherlock just got owned. Like, he got a taste of his own bloody medicine.
Exactly.
And then paid for it at the end, and then he doesn't go to jail because fucking his brother is more powerful than the Prime Minister and the Queen combined. That's who we should really blame, Mycroft Holmes.
always blame the British government. Yeah, and he basically owes the British government.
Yeah, Mycroft is a Tory. That'd be hilarious. But yeah, no, the idea that, right, let's, so for those of you who haven't seen season 3 of Sherlock, I don't know if you want to, but at the end of the season, it's revealed that Magnus, so Lars Mikkelsen's character has revealed that all this information that he's threatened very powerful people with isn't stored on some computer, it's stored in his mind palace.
Mm-hmm. And he uses all this information to blackmail people, and that's why he looks quote unquote terrifying, because he could do anything to anyone and they couldn't do anything about it because he had dirt on every single person. Mm-hmm. So Sherlock was tasked with this mission to retrieve whatever info that Lars Mikkelsen's character had on Mary, who was being threatened, Mary being of course John's wife, and he was ready to go in there, and he thought he was going to play Lars Mikkelsen. He was so confident until he, you know, opens the doors to his so-called what was it, the library or whatever, and it's just a chair. It's just a chair. And as an audience member, I think we have the same, like, it's artful how they did it, and how we had the same moment of like rainbow wheel of death, where we're like, that's a chair, where is the stairs, where are we, what is that, until it sort of like slowly sinks in, like,
like, of course on this show we're seeing the inside of someone's head, of course that's what
exactly.
Let's get into the mind palace a little bit. I feel like we can't do this episode without talking about what that is. So the mind palace is a memory technique that Sherlock,
a real one, by the way,
a real one, it's a real one, but the way they portray it on the show is iconic, to say the least. It's in many GIFs now. It's very big brain. It's in the show it's a bunch of pictures floating around that he sort of swats away and chooses. But
funnily enough, we never actually see Sherlock's mind palace. Oh no, we did briefly while he was dying.
Only when he was dying.
But we don't really see how he only when he was dying, but we never see how he employs it as a memory or an info storage space, because when he was in his mind palace it was only like his dead dog, his dead nemesis, and Molly Hooper.
Molly Hooper,
you know. So I just thought, now that I'm thinking about it, it's just interesting that we never really see this so-called incredible, like, you know, brain that he has, and that he stores all this information, and we just see it in like flying, you know, pictures and incomprehensible formulas where he just kind of like flicks away at, and it looks like he's conducting something.
I was like, oh my god, it's giving Doctor Strange. Maybe that's how he got the part. I was like, you know,
why would you say this of all times? Don't bring up the MCU.
It's gross. I hate bringing it up. It's one of those things also that I despise talking about, but I feel like sometimes I have to unpack, just like this show.
Have you done an episode on that, by the way? They, like,
I've got
of the MCU.
I've got like a mini series. It's me and Noshad, and we just like talk shit about it for 3 hours.
Very cool.
The Mind Palace is interesting to me because I think Magnuson's system makes a lot more sense because it's a library, and that's like the thing is, like, you have to picture something, you know, visual, and that makes sense. And I think libraries, obviously there is a filing system and that's easy to access, you know, but Sherlock's feels very abstract, and that goes back to whole, and it goes back to Irene, the whole thing of like smart being the new sexy, like that became such a thing. It made me gag, but also, like, I mean, being smart is fucking awesome, you know, in an age where there's like rampant anti-intellectualism. I think Sherlock's, albeit almost facetious hyper-intellectualism, was a bizarre turn of events. I think the fact that we went from this like, yeah, let's all try and do our own little mind palaces, to now that's like nobody's thinking, which is
I don't
like,
so, you know, true. Yeah, it was so, that's so funny that you mention it at the time. Like, now obviously it's like super cool to be a nerd and everyone's doing it, but at the time nobody wanted to be, you know, it was like this like taboo thing to be intelligent or to be knowledgeable about things. And I think Sherlock, you know, brainy is the new sexy, like that really like hit a chord in some of our like people, those weird like you know,
nerds,
fake intelligent ones,
pretentious dicks, and that thing of like, yeah, valuing intelligence over say social skills, or you know, like that was also interesting as well. Have you ever tried to build a mind palace?
Oh god, no. I don't have anything in my brain worth storing that way.
Oh my gosh, I think in like senior year during exams, I tried to do it with some formulas because I knew I wasn't gonna have a book.
Oh, wow.
And like the house was really funny that I pictured, because I was like, it's not even my like, it's not even my dream house at all. But I remember there's a beach, and I would always, because you always, the process is you always have to go through the house the same way, and that's how you remember stuff.
Right, that explains a lot about Mickelson actually. Yeah.
That's like the way the whole system works. And then I think mine was like, you know, there's like a beach, and then the windows are really, really high, and then there's like a couch and the checkered floors, and then the kitchen, and then there's a photo in the kitchen that's like a physics what's it, a physics formula that I only used once in an exam.
Did it work for you?
For a short period of time where I was like thinking about it and like,
right,
but then obviously my brain, the way it is, there's too much going on, and it doesn't, yeah, order doesn't really order and routine only last for a certain number of times, so it didn't really it didn't work for me. I couldn't store government secrets, you know what I mean? Like, I can barely remember. No. I said this yesterday. I was like, I can't remember what I had for breakfast, but I remember like a Naruto jutsu that I learned at age 8. You know, like, that's how fucked up it is. And I want to touch on that thing you said earlier about how everyone's a fucking nerd now.
Mm.
And back then, being a nerd was still being a nerd. And I think it's really funny, because I think Sherlock did have like something to do with it a little bit. Maybe, yeah, season 2, season 3.
Well, 100%.
Yeah. And I think the MCU does as well, obviously. And now everyone fucking likes comic book movies but won't read a single comic book. And I'm just like,
of course.
Are you about it? Yeah. Are you about it, dog? Are you about it, really? And then, like, people that we went to high school with that would never touch an anime in their life, or would used to make fun of people that were into anime, are now into, like, Attack on Titan. And I'm like, what? Like,
yeah.
It's such an interesting cultural shift to me. I don't know. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, because I think we both think about this a lot.
Yeah, I mean, if you even just looking at the other fiction that existed around that time, how Gossip Girl and like Pretty Little Liars, you know, glorified these like women who were really into like fashion and socializing and things like that, but not so much into like learning, I guess. That sounds terrible. And a lot of the stories around then, anytime a nerd was depicted, it would be in this very like almost derogatory way. I mean, you mentioned Troy and Abed, and obviously they're very dear to a lot of people, but they were very much like, they're a little weird,
dorky. and that was a thing on the show.
Yeah, right, exactly. So at the time, that was how they were, like, all nerds were just portrayed as the weird ones, these oddities almost in society. And now we have this increasing rise of like nerds being seen as powerful, nerds being seen as desirable. You see this with the introduction of things like Social Network. I think this was one of the earlier ones where, well, okay, I wouldn't say he was glorified as a nerd. He was very much painted as an asshole, as he should be. But, you know, the fact that he made that sort of like empire for himself was very much, I don't know, I think it was glorified by a lot of people. These new, you know, we have people like Tony Stark, who obviously was born into a rich and powerful family, but he also had this incredible, incredible brain that allowed him to become Iron Man. We have real life examples of billionaires who are also very intelligent, and I refuse to say their names.
Ridiculous people.
No, absolutely, right? But you know, they have these like cult followings, and everybody, they're treated as like these A-list celebrities, because it's now very, very cool to be intelligent and to use that intelligence to make a name for yourself.
Now that you said that, I think like that kind of shift about what, you know, being into something means does have a lot to do with like accruing capital, or who has, because I think nerds are now a huge market, and I think if you're not pandering to the nerds, you're not going to make any money, you
absolutely
know?
Absolutely.
And it's wild to me, like you know, The Last of Us, you know, has just come out, and that was adapted from a game that came out in 2013,
and Dungeons and Dragons coming out soon.
D&D, the poster child for D&D now is Chris Pine, like,
right,
you know. And or then, or rather
Stranger
like
Things as well. I also had a huge Deborah Ann Wall's in that one. Shut up.
No, she's into Dungeons and Dragons. She does like a D&D show.
You scared me.
But that's also again like a niche thing of like I know about that because I really like Daredevil and I really like Dungeons and Dragons, so obviously I would know about that. But then people are there, but yeah, like you say, like people's first introductions to D&D, yeah, Stranger Things, or like yeah, this movie coming out that stars bloody, you know, the Chris, in my opinion,
the number one Chris,
the number one Chris, the number one white Chris.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, it's just mad to me that like. Because, and again, I think we can attribute it to like, you know, young women liking stuff,
right?
It has such, you know, one, like social capital and obviously like actual capital in the sense that this is who you're gonna sell to, this is who you're gonna market to, and it's crazy to me now that like that everyone's just into everything and it's become mass culture, it's become mass
culture. 100%. I don't know if you remember being told this. I'm sure you must have, but sometime around my late teens, people were constantly saying, "Hey, you should go after nerds. They're going to be rich one day. You should go after the nerds."
Oh my god. Yeah.
You know, you should, they're going to be the ones that are making all the money in a couple of years. You should definitely go after a nerd. Forget about the jocks. They're never going to go anywhere. Go for the nerds instead. And that was a thing that was constantly repeated to me.
Yeah. I was like, "Oh, he's going to get into a good school." And he's going to get work for a good company. He is going to have a stable life. And I'm like, oh. I was like, yo, but what about me though? Like, and I was like, yeah, went to bloody film school. So no.
No, that's true. No, you're a starving artist. I'm sorry to say.
I know. Yeah. I'm sort of, oh gosh, we'll get into that later. I've been having so many conversations with people about how just like art as a commodity, which I think relates back to this, just being like, it's so weird that we're commodifying something so personal. And the fact that like, it's so obvious now that, you know, remakes and reboots and stuff like that, and obviously to some extent Sherlock started out this way, like it's because this shit keeps happening because we're making art for money and not to express ourselves. And that's, that goes for the MCU, that goes for, you know, Supernatural getting a reboot, that goes for
100%. And it's the Teen Wolf movie.
The Teen Wolf movie. Oh my god, I really want to talk to you about that, but we'll do it another time. But yeah, I know, and it's just madness to me that like it's so subtle in a shift in our world, but now it's more evident than ever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Damn. Before we wrap up, we started getting really deep. To Stephen Moffat can't take credit for any of that. We're just like, you know.
No, absolutely not. He needs to take credit for my like freaking therapy bills,
mental illness,
but
yeah.
Exactly.
I wanted to talk a tiny bit about Super Hulock. Because this is the lock part of Super Hulock. So what was that to you? Also tell the audience at home what that is, if you can.
Right. Super Hulock stands for Supernatural, Doctor Who, BBC Sherlock, and these were three of the most prominent fandoms on the internet, most specifically on Tumblr at the time, and we unfortunately were chronic Tumblr dwellers. They were everywhere. You couldn't go into any section of the internet at the time and not run into someone who was either in at least one, but most likely two or three of these fandoms. Personally, at the time, I was very much into, what do you call them? Britophile?
Anglophile.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, you were, yeah.
I was 100% an Anglophile. I like dreamed of moving to the UK and I wanted it to be English. And it was just,
and then you got there and
cringe.
You hated it.
No, actually, that was my experience.
Lynn lived with me for a bit in London this summer. And it was just like, how do you live like this?
I don't want to talk like smack about another country, but like, I don't look at it fondly in any way. But I, you know, being so anglophilic, I was very much into Doctor Who and BBC Sherlock, not so much about Supernatural. I will say that as I've grown up, I actually started watching Supernatural, and now I'm technically a Super Hulockian, and I can't believe this is something I could say in like the God's year 2023 as a 24-year-old. Like,
at age 24,
what,
at your big age.
Right? It's embarrassing. Embarrassing, but genuinely, they were just, I don't know, even without consuming all three of these things, I saw so much content of all three of these things that I was kind of like a fan by proxy.
Yeah, by osmosis.
You know, especially because I was friends with this hoe that I'm speaking to right now, and they are
everything.
They were such a massive like super, what is it, like supernatural super head or whatever.
I don't know what the name is called, and I was the one that fucking watched the show, innit, like
whatever. Yeah, exactly. That's on. You're insane.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's a lot of like, you know, fan by osmosis thing, and it was inescapable.
Yeah, and like I think that's how I found out about Supernatural, through Sherlock.
Yeah.
and Doctor Who. And I found that about this out, like I found about it in like the reverse, like I didn't realize they were separate entities, or Supernatural was a separate entity, until I looked into it. I was like, oh, there is a lot of crossover. That's what I like read. That was my like, oh, it's kind of cool. There was lots of like crossover fan fiction from that little world, and I'm like, oh shit, damn, you can do that. a gateway drug. And also, like, again, going back to like fan fiction, I had so much respect for people who could just write full,
yeah,
you know, chaptered stories and update regularly. I was so fucking jealous, and I still am now, like as a writer, like this is what I do for a living. I'm still so jealous of these people that can just crank shit out and it's good, like, and they have their bosses and their, you know, like editors. It's grand.
The fact that they aren't paid for the kind of work that they do is actually such a testament, first of all, to like humanity's love for art and just making things, right? Mm-hmm. But also kind of criminal, because some of the best bodies of work I've ever read in my life are fan fiction.
Literally, are on AO3. Yeah. I was like, why don't you have a book deal? And then I found out, oh shit, they got a book deal. I was like, damn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, this is where they get their start, and it's phenomenal, the kind of work they make. And
yeah,
they're also significantly better in quality, I will say, than any like book that was originally on Wattpad and then got turned into like a YA novel that is now hugely popular. I will not name many names, but unfortunately I've heard one of them is being, you know, turned into a film soon.
I find that so, like, it's one of those things that make me really like sentimental about this part of our lives, because like this is where a lot of people got their start, and this is how I think we both got our start in terms of like our creative work. Like, you know, it felt, the stakes were low and we weren't creating for money, and I think that, like, I don't know, I need to revisit how that made me feel to kind of rejig my career, because I've had so many conversations about how, like, yo, I don't want to be in this rat race. I hate, like, you know, I don't want to keep. I was listening to a podcast the other day, it's called Jaded Forum, it's really good. I've been talking about it nonstop to like everyone I know, but they were saying on there that, like, at least in the creative industries, or at least specifically comedy, like whenever you get to do stuff, it just feels like you're just adding stuff to your CV, and it feels like you're paying rent for your own career for something down the line. And I was like, damn, that's hard. And also, oh, that's why I feel so horrible about myself all the time. And I'm like, fuck, that's insane. But yeah, I like that I have this and I can just do this for fun with my mates, and that's how it should stay. But if you want to give us money, please give us money, because, you know, my ass is broke.
Yeah, there are starving artists, please.
Literally, emphasis on starving. I'm grand. I have to work 3 jobs to stay alive in the city anyway.
No biggie, whatever.
Just been a workaholic since day one. A tiny note before we go, what are your thoughts on Benedict Cumberbatch?
Ugh.
I forgot to touch on this. I should have touched
those
on this
are my too. Comprehensive notes. Ugh. Yeah. Ugh. I remember there was a point where I made the very deliberate conscious decision not to give a shit about him anymore, but I kind of forgot why until very recently. I came across a thread that kind of rehashed all of this, and he's like, you know, he's very chronically a rich British man.
Oh yeah,
that's like
bloody hell.
Yeah, he's just very, he's very like elitist. Yes, he is. Yeah. He's very elitist, very like posh to the point of clearly out of touch with reality.
Oh yeah,
you know. I think I'm pretty sure he's royalist, and that immediately makes me kind
gross.
Ugh. You know, I don't care how good he is as an actor. And I will admit, you know, I there was a point in my life where he very much motivated me to like love acting, because he was so good at it. And but like, I can't perceive him as a person anymore, knowing that he's kind of very different to me ideologically. I'll say it like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was just like, straight by shitty. Also, I feel like nowadays, with as much fame he garnered, obviously off the back of Sherlock, I feel like sometimes he plays the same character in different fonts. He's one of those people. especially later on in his career. Like, I don't know, every time I see them stupid MCU movies, it's like Doctor Strange is just Sherlock with an American accent. And
yeah.
And he
I guess, like, good for him for getting that bag out of the same things over and over again.
Yeah. But I mean, if it ain't broke, he ain't clearly not broke. He clearly is not broke. But yeah. Any final thoughts, Lynn, on Sherlock?
On Sherlock?
Or just as an experience?
I am cringe, but I'm free. Yeah. I will continue to love that show as terrible as I know it to be now. Mm-hmm. And it will still feed my soul whenever my soul needs that kind of, like, brainless, thoughtless entertainment.
Yeah. I love that it's brainless and thoughtless, and, like, he's so
this, like, super smart guy.
Really, I was like, it's so funny. And I'm like, yeah, no, this is my Kardashians, you know, when I put on BBC Sherlock. I can have it in the background.
But, like, you know that they have impact when, like, so many tweets and so many TikToks, even now, are still like, whenever I miss my phone charger trying to plug my phone in, I think of that one scene. Yeah. And they didn't even specify it's from Sherlock. They just call it that one scene. And we all know what they're talking about.
We all know where that's from. Oh my God. She was that bitch.
She was a cultural moment. She was an icon, a legend.
Yeah, we love Lara Pulver, I hope you're well, wherever you are.
Shout out.
But yeah, do you think the show, I know that capitalism doesn't breed innovation because it's a disease. Do you think they would ever bring it back? And if they were to bring it back, what do you think would happen on it?
I have heard that they will never bring it back because Martin and Benedict fell out at some point.
Oh, tea.
Yeah.
That's why you and never see Everett Ross and Stephen Strange in the same room.
Exactly. It's like, yeah, they put it in the contract. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know if they'll ever bring it back. I don't know if I ever want them to. I think I'm very happy to have the canon be what it is. I think they ended it on, like, a strong note. And I'm very happy for the fanon to be what it is. I love the way that people have explored those characters through, you know, fan works and things like that. And I think it's a pretty good, like, we've reached a good balance of those two.
Yeah, leave well enough alone, as they say.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Capitalism doesn't know how to leave well enough alone. But yeah, before we go, Lynn, have you been listening to, reading, or watching anything interesting aside from Sherlock that you'd recommend to our listeners, if there are any listeners?
Well, okay, so watching, I recently finished Schitt's Creek, so technically I don't know if I can recommend this because everybody's probably watched it already, but it's such a great sitcom, and it's I love David Rose so much. I've never related to a character more. So I would recommend that. Reading, I'm not reading anything. Well, okay, technically I'm reading my first Stephen King novel ever. I'm reading Pet Sematary.
I knew that reaction.
I know. Gosh. I was like, I'm kind of like dipping my toes in. I didn't know if I was gonna like it or not because I'm not a big horror person. Yeah, but like so far, I'm really impressed with the storytelling and like I really like the way it's going. So I'm happy to say that.
Good.
Okay. So that's something I'm reading at the moment, and something I'm listening to. Let me think.
You say Taylor Swift, I'll fight you.
No, not just yet. I'm waiting for the Speak Now TV announcement. But I have been listening to an album called, oh crap, this is a Korean artist. Her name is Bibi, that's B-I-B-I, and she recently dropped an album that I think is so like female murderous rage.
Hell yeah.
Like fuel drugs. And exactly. And I absolutely love it. The title of the album is Low Life Princess Noir.
Ooh.
That's a sick title. I've never thought of, okay, wow. That's hard. Low Life Princess Noir. It's got apparently 12 songs and every single one of them fuck heavy. So highly recommend that one.
Hell yeah. I think I heard Bibi on she featured on Second, I think. Yeah, right?
Bye.
What's her name? I'm so bad with remembering names. It's like, especially with K-pop, it's actually awful. Like I should do a better job. You know. Yeah, it's I don't know how to say her name as well. From Girls' Generation.
Spell it out, girl.
Hyoyeon.
No shit. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I was like, I know that name. I was like, oh yeah, no,
that is sexy.
Yeah,
that
it's
is
a Grey Hillion song.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'm literally, I grew up listening to Girl Generation, but I can't remember any one of their names unless it's like Tiffany or Yuri, like the easy ones.
So American of you. Yuri, know. Just okay, saying it like that makes it sound Yuri. So kampungan.
Yeah, it's so jammed. But yeah, Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. This is
thank you.
Brilliant. We'd love to have you back. But yeah, you can follow us at ADTLM Podcast on Twitter. Check us out at breadcrumbscollective.com, home to the Breadcrumbs Collective Network. You can follow me at Ariane Anandita on Twitter and Instagram. And yeah, let us know what your feelings are towards BBC Sherlock, if you have any attachment to it as we do. I would love to hear your thoughts, because this was a moment in time. And yeah, see you next time on this show that puts out episodes once every blue moon. So yeah, thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Bye.